Hey folks, welcome back to this week's Whitetail Watch podcast presented by Realtree. Their longtime slogan has been family, friends, and the outdoors. And that's one of the main reasons why we love that relationship with Realtree, is because they are all grassroots hunters that are totally on board with what we are talking about on today's podcast. And that is getting more people involved in hunting, the social aspect of hunting, time in the outdoors, everything. And they're a huge proponent of supporting these conservation groups. In fact, they are working right now with various agencies out there that are trying to combat this problem. So when you can, support Realtree and their camo patterns. They're extremely effective. They've been around for many, many years. Been wearing it since I was a kid. And right now they've got lots of cool deals over at their Realtree online store. Bow season is right around the corner for many of us. And one thing that we are constantly packing to the field that is extremely handy are those Realtree easy hangers. Right now they've got multiple models of them available on their online store. I believe they're selling a three pack with three different hangers in it with different lengths, different adjustabilities. Great little piece of gear to have with you. Once you use one of these things, you'll tote it with you every time that you go to the tree stand. So go over to the Realtree online store, check out their easy hangers, and get geared up for deer season. We're going to have an interesting topic for today's show. We're going to talk about something that's very important, and it's probably not getting enough press right now. It's the lack of hunter numbers in the U.S., specifically whitetail hunter numbers. They are going down. Some of you may already be aware of this, but on today's podcast, we're going to talk about some scary stuff, and it's on the not-too-distant horizon right ahead of us. If we don't start doing something about it real soon, it's going to be bad for hunting anything. So on today's podcast, I'm going to bring on my good friend and actually my cousin, Chris Willingham. He's the principal of the high school that I graduated from back in 2005, Paris R2, a little town of about 1,000 people. And Chris actually graduated from the same high school back in the late 90s. I'll have to ask him to check and make sure which year exactly. But I'm going to get his perspective on the high school kids nowadays and how involved they are in the outdoors compared to when he was in high school about 20 years ago. And nowadays, I don't think you all would be surprised by this, but things are definitely much, much different. And Chris is going to lay out that stuff for us. He's an avid outdoorsman and fully supports hunting and getting kids involved in schools and stuff. So we're going to have Chris on to talk about that perspective. And then in addition to that, I'm going to have on my buddy Scott Vance, who is the CEO of the Union Sportsman's Alliance. He's worked with them now for a couple of years, I believe. And before that, he worked for the National Wild Turkey Federation as their VP of Hunting Heritage. And he was responsible for a thing that we call R3. And that is hunter recruitment, retention, and reactivation. Basically, in layman's terms, that means finding new hunters, because that's our main problem right now. Our license sales are dropping. Our number of whitetail hunters is dropping every year, and that's because the average hunter is getting older and they're not getting replaced. But we'll get into all that on today's podcast. We're going to talk about the problems, the repercussions that we may see in the next few years if we don't act very soon. And we'll also talk about some possible solutions on the podcast. So I'm going to go ahead and give Chris and Scott a call, and we'll dive right off into this topic. All right. I've now got my my buddy Chris Willingham, who's the principal there at Paris High School, on the line, and the CEO of the Union Sportsman's Alliance, Mr. Scott Vance. Scott, how you doing?
Doing good, Aaron. Good to talk to you.
Yes, sir. We go way back. I always enjoy getting on the phone with you and rattling your cage a little bit on some of this stuff, and we're definitely going to do it today. I've got a lot of questions that I'd like to address in this one. And Chris, how are things back home in Paris?
They're going really well. It's hot and dry, but no, everything's been going really well, man. Just about ready to get another school year started, and I'm trying to finish out this summer well. But yeah, glad to be here and glad to chat with you, man.
Hey, man, you've been running around the T-ball fields up there for a while, haven't you?
Yeah, definitely. Got the kids about every night of the week on ball fields. And if we're not doing that, we're out in the garden or picking blackberries or riding around looking for deer, doing something like that. So it's been busy for sure.
That's good. Scott, you all just wrapped up with ball season. Your son, y'all went pretty deep into the summer, didn't you?
We did. Started way back in March and pretty much practiced 2-3 times a week and had games almost every weekend. We just finished last weekend the Tennessee State Championships, and then he starts football on Saturday. So there is no rest.
Cool. Well, I won't BS any longer. We'll go ahead and get into the meat of this conversation because there's going to be a lot of it, I have a feeling. I'm going to start out talking with you first, Chris.
All right, sounds good.
I've already addressed in the intro to the podcast the main subject that we're going to be talking about today, and that is the decrease in hunter numbers that we've got going on right now, especially in the whitetail world. And it's some pretty scary stuff that we've got going on, and I think a lot of people can identify with it. But I want you to talk about, first off, you're the principal at the same high school that you graduated from. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yep, I graduated high school in 1999 from Paris, and started working there again in 2008. I've been a principal for 4 years, getting ready to start my fifth.
And I remember, when I was growing up, I was following all you guys around all the time, you know, as I was getting older, because all y'all were in the woods constantly. And I remember how much time that y'all spent outdoors when I was real young. And I want you to just lay out for the listeners right now what the main differences are in the way that the kids have changed. You know, how many kids hunt now in the high school compared to how many hunted back in the late 90s when you were in high school? And obviously there's lots of factors that come into play there, but I'd like for you to kind of lay out what you see as the main difference.
Sure. Yeah. You know, when I was in high school, I can think back, probably count on one hand the amount of kids that didn't hunt. You know, I mean, it was, you'd get on the phone in the evening after you'd be on the deer stand, and you'd call 10 different guys and see what all they saw, and if they had any luck, or, you know, if somebody was fortunate enough to get one, you jump in the truck and go help them look for it. But everybody in our high school was involved in the outdoors in some way, shape, or form, and there was a lot of bow hunters, a lot of avid bow hunters, that any free time they had from practices or anything like that, they were out in the woods. You know, what I see from our kids today is there's a few kids that still get out to the woods for gun season, but they just don't put the time in during bow season. The numbers aren't there. You know, I said before I could count on one hand the number of kids that didn't hunt. Now I could say I could probably come up with on one hand the number of kids that do. It's been a pretty crazy change for me to see, you know, throughout the years. And I'm sure it would be for you as well. A lot of kids in your grade and around you hunted. We just don't have near the amount of kids that hunt. I'm sure there's lots and lots of different reasons for it, but it's a huge difference for me to notice it. You know, if I could try to talk to these kids about hunting in the outdoors, I'll spend a day or two out there during rifle season, but that's about it. They're not getting out there and bow hunting, and it seems like it's kind of a dying industry.
And Scott, just to put this in perspective here, Paris, Missouri is very small. It is a rural farming community, and sure. it's the place where if people are going to hunt, they're going to, you know, this is where they're going to do it, because we're surrounded by deer and deer hunting and all kinds of stuff. And I'm just guessing that the scenario that Chris is talking about is pretty common across most of the core whitetail hunter states. Am I right?
It is. You know, what we're seeing pretty much nationwide is exactly what you're describing. We're seeing a couple of trends. We're seeing the majority of the population move towards more of a urban or suburban lifestyle. And we're certainly seeing, you know, the young people and even their parents moving towards fewer and fewer days spent afield. There are very few of what we call the super avids, and those are that's us. And it actually is becoming not me, even though I am, the executive director and CEO of a conservation organization. Everybody thinks I have all these opportunities to go hunting. I find myself trying to balance between family obligations, work, and just the aspect of time. It's not necessarily not having a place to go. It's not necessarily not having the money to go, but it is just absolutely time. And I think everybody is experiencing that same phenomenon across the United States. And it's really making wildlife professionals question, how are we going to maintain the level of hunting, the level of conservation funding that we need for the future? Because it's playing out everywhere. Everybody's seeing it on a small local level. And what we're seeing from the national trends as far as avid hunters, you know, people that spend more than 20 days afield, that's what they consider an avid. Which, you know, some of us back in the day, I hate to admit it, I spent hundreds of days in the field. And I'm sure a few people still do. But, you know, we're seeing that avid number really decline. And we're seeing more and more people who actually still consider themselves hunters, but they may only go once or twice a year, or they may only go every 1 or 2 years. They just don't hunt nearly as much as we used to hunt.
And Chris, what do your kids in high school do now? You know, I mean, like we were just talking about back when you all were, you know, in high school in the late 90s, I saw you guys playing football every Friday night, and then I'd see you in full camo the next day at the gas station with half the football team with you. You know, I mean, everybody was constantly outside doing something. But what do they do now? What do they spend their time doing now?
Felt like when I was in high school that we were busy. We had part-time jobs. You mentioned sports. We were involved in, you know, all different sporting seasons. But every time we had an opportunity to get out in the woods, you wake up early in the morning, throw your clothes on, go hunt that afternoon or that evening, get off football practice, take a quick shower, jump out in the tree, did everything you possibly could to get outside. And the kids now, I don't know, it's one thing to play, you know, to lay your finger on and say that's definitely it. But I can tell you that, you know, with a lot of our technology, I mean, our kids are really, really, really into gaming, even for our community. And they're also cell phones glued to their hands, and they're constantly, you know, involved in that and what's going on. But it just doesn't seem like we've got a lot of kids that are getting outside. I mean, you used to even see the parks, you know, the ballpark, baseball field, there'd be kids up there throwing a ball, playing, or basketball or something like that. It just doesn't seem like the kids are that interested in it that more. And they just seems like everything just goes a lot faster, I guess, if that makes any sense. There's just a whole lot going on, and they're buying into all of it, just trying to find, you know, that next fad that they can get excited with.
You know, I've seen that same thing. Certainly I've got a 10-year-old, and he has a ton of options. I mean, if I sit here, I live, you know, 20 minutes from Nashville, Tennessee. And so if we want to go do something, I mean, we could get in the car right now, and there's probably 100 things, you know, at 9 o'clock at night that we could go do in Nashville, Tennessee, that would just be so much more exciting than going out and sitting in a cold tree stand to a 10-year-old. Now, he loves to be with his dad, and he actually loves to fish. But when it comes to hunting, unless it's pretty much, you know, a quick hunt, or we're seeing stuff the whole time, or there's just a whole lot of action, it takes him about 10 minutes to get bored. And I've taken out a number of hunters in the last few years, a number of younger hunters, they experience the same thing. It's very unusual to find a child now, you know, that's 8, 9, 10 years old, even 12 or 13, that really wants to go out there and spend the time, that wants to put down the gaming devices, that wants to put down, you know, their phone or their iPad or whatever. And quite honestly, wants to not be doing what their other friends are doing. And a lot of that that I've seen with kids is kind of the peer pressure. I mean, it's not a bad thing. It's a great thing if you're doing the right thing. peer pressure can be great. And I think that's what we all experienced. I mean, I grew up the same way. I grew up 20 years before Aaron did, 10 years before he did. And so I was in high school there, and we played football on Friday nights. We went hunting on Saturdays. During the evenings, during the week, if we didn't have football practice or if we got out early, we went hunting. That's just what we did. But now I didn't have, a game pad or an iPad or an iPhone or any of that stuff back then. And I also, I played four sports all the way through. But we only played, even in high school, maybe 15 or 20 baseball games. My child's 10 years old, and he just topped out 40 games this year.
I've noticed a huge change in that as well, and that goes right along with what Aaron was saying about, kids being busy. It's the same thing for us in our high schools. We didn't used to have contact days during the summer. We might have a week-long camp for football, a week-long camp for basketball, a camp for baseball. We play some Legion baseball games or something during the summer. Now we're allowed, I want to say it's 20 contact days per sport. And so if a kid plays four sports, like you mentioned, they could have 80 contact days in a summer. Now there's not 80 days in the summer, but we've got kids that are lifting at 6 o'clock in the morning. Then they're going to, their different sporting events throughout the day. And then even during the seasons, we've got a lot of club ball and things like that are going on. And we do have some kids that are playing upwards of 80 to 100 ball games throughout a year, including what we do in the high school. So there's definitely been a big change there as well. So I've seen that for sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, and here's the thing. We're talking about all the reasons, for what we're experiencing. And it's a definite decline. If you look at the total population across the United States, if you look at percentage of people in the United States who hunt, it continues to decline, even though the numbers of hunters, as far as total numbers, has creeped up slightly. That's been just in a couple of places. I can tell you a lot of those numbers are drawing a little bit of skepticism as far as where they came from, because it was only in two or three states where we saw most of those increases. A lot of that was in how they counted hunters. And quite honestly, a lot of that, and this is a great thing, a lot of that is in female hunters. And as you know, the industry, you don't have to look very far to see that the industry has put some significant time and money towards attracting female hunters and anglers, and it's working. And that's fantastic. And I'll throw in a tidbit. Aaron's heard me say this before. I can tell you when I interact with a family and when I talk to a family of hunters and anglers, if mama doesn't hunt, then there's a real good chance that vacations and time after school and, weekends are going to include a lot of things other than hunting and fishing. If mama does hunt in a family, there's a really good chance that weekends and after school is going to include fishing and hunting. And I can just tell you that flat out. So recruiting females into the sport, or into hunting and angling and shooting, is really, really important. The other thing that I feel is important is, if you look at all the different sports, if you look at all the different things that we're doing out there and all the different things that kids have available to them, the things that they have the most affinity for and tend to gravitate the most towards are the things that their friends are doing and the things that they have very structured ways to achieve different levels, to get recognition, to gain acceptance by their friends and their peers. And if you think about it, hunting and fishing really used to be that way. It used to be that you had the camp type setup. We went to fishing camp or we went to hunting camp. It was, you had your elders in camp that told the stories and everybody, it was a group affair. Everybody told a lot of hunting stories. Now it's become more of a solitary type sport, to be honest. A lot of people hunt all year and they don't hunt with anybody else. They just go and pursue deer or turkey by themselves. Whereas all the other sports, you think about basketball and football and baseball, and certainly a lot of other organized things like gymnastics and soccer, those are very structured sports where you have a place that you go, you have a time that you go, you're practicing, you're playing games, you have ways to get recognized for achievement. Have a coach, you know, you have an expert there. If you think about the way hunting and fishing used to be, it was a lot the same. You know, you had a destination, you had somebody there that knew what they were doing, you got recognized for some achievement. I think that the key to getting the youth back into hunting and fishing is to create that same type of environment for hunting and fishing that we have with these other sports. And that's going to take, you know, a considerable commitment from a lot of people who want to mentor, and it's going to take considerable amount of money and emphasis from our state agency wildlife partners as well to make that happen.
Well, I'll just put some things in perspective right now for the listeners, and this might be part of the scary part that I was talking about earlier, but I'm just going to take the state of Iowa right now where I'm sitting as an example. And like Scott mentioned, there's numbers on all this stuff floating around everywhere, so it's hard to trust, you know, one thing from the next. But I've heard from the Iowa DNR itself, and I've looked at a number of different statistics, some of which are through U.S. Fish and Wildlife and some other agencies. But I believe now will be the eighth or ninth year in a row in which Iowa's youth hunter recruitment has gone down. And in fact, I think their overall license holders is about as low as it's been in 25 or 30 years, which is extremely scary because of what Scott just said. A lot of these licenses, a lot of the sales are what pay for the DNR and conservation in the state. And when you don't have that, when you don't have hunters, eventually you're not going to have hunting. And this isn't just happening in Iowa. It's happening in lots and lots of states, especially with whitetail hunting. And like what Scott just said, whitetail hunting is turning into more of an isolated type of an activity. It's not a social event anymore. And it's pretty scary to think about. I think the Iowa DNR is on a like a really long hiring freeze right now. In fact, a couple years maybe where they're not hiring anybody because I don't think they have the funding.
Well, they are, Aaron, and I can tell you exactly how these wildlife agencies are funded. Of course, I come from a wildlife agency background, and I've been in the nonprofit world for almost 20 years now. But the way that they get their funding is based on the number of licensed hunters and anglers that they have. That's how they get their federal funding. You know, when we buy firearms and ammunition, or shooters go out and you know, buy ammunition, or we buy different equipment, there's an excise tax that goes towards Pittman Robertson and Dingle Johnson funds. And that money's held in a federal coffer. And the way the states get that money is they have to turn in the number of licensed hunters and anglers that they have. And that's what their funding from the feds depends on. They also get that money from license sales. So if you have fewer licensed hunters and anglers, they get a double whammy. So if they don't have as many people fishing and hunting, they don't get as much from the license revenue, but they also don't get that federal funding, which is really important. And then if you look at the whole nation, end to end, nationwide, about 85% of all conservation funding, not just for hunting and fishing, but for all conservation, whether it's your national parks, your wildlife refuges, anything end to end, 85% of all that funding is generated by recreational shooters, by hunters, and by anglers. That's pretty scary.
Oh yeah, darn right it's scary. What do you think, Chris? Is the hunting gotten better or worse as far as the deer quality goes in Missouri in the last 20 years? From where I'm sitting up here, we've had our ups and downs in Iowa for some time now, but the hunter numbers just keep going down. I mean, our local high school here in town doesn't have hardly any hunters in it, and we're right here in Albia. We're like the capital of southern Iowa whitetail hunting. I mean, we're the mecca that everybody wants to come and hunt at.
Absolutely. I promise if you'd invite me up there, I'd go.
Me too. But, I can't get anybody either, Chris.
Yeah. But no, as far as whitetail hunting, you know, in Missouri and what I've seen in the last 20 or so years, it's just exactly as you said. There's been peaks and valleys. you know, we, through disease and things like that, probably 5 years ago, we had a pretty rough couple seasons, and then saw a decent, you know, influx of deer the last few years. But it's real hit or miss. You'll talk to some people, you know, with prime habitats, that really, really are enjoying it and having a great time. You'll talk to a few other people that struggle to see deer, and they may only be, you know, 5 to 10 miles apart or even closer than that. And with the sheer numbers of people that have dropped off, you know, from hunting, we're starting to see, or I'm personally starting to see, you know, a lot of small family farms that are being bought up by, you know, by bigger farmers or by corporation, you know, corporate farmers. And we're starting to see, you know, access, denied, you know, to a lot of people where they used to be able to hunt. I think I told you in a conversation, a couple weeks ago that we'd had that, when I was 10 years old, I think I could have walked 5 miles in any direction, told you exactly whose land I was on, and could have told you that I had permission to hunt on that ground. If I were to go right back to my childhood home and walk that same direction 5 miles in any way, I'm probably going to get arrested for one, because, you know, I don't know who owns that property anymore. And I can assure you that it'd be very difficult to get permission, you know, on those properties. And so I've noticed a huge change there, but, definitely seeing, you know, peaks and valleys, you know, for our deer. It's, you know, still, of course, enjoy the outdoors and love it. And that's what it's all about, being out there. But, definitely, there's some frustrating years for sure.
Same issues here, Chris. I mean, I'm just moved here to the Nashville area, and I can tell you that getting access here is very difficult because of the land ownership. We have a lot of folks that aren't from this area that moved here, and you know, quite honestly, that they like watching the deer and turkey. They don't want you shooting them. And then the bigger landowners, you know, they have, they've been leased. You know, there's a lot of brokers working in the area. There's a lot of leases going on. And, you know, even in what I would consider just marginal whitetail habitat here, as far as quality, you know, you're looking at $15, $20 an acre, you know, to lease a piece of property to hunt on. And, that's just not financially sound for a lot of families to do when they have all these other things going on. I mean, when you're spending $2,000 on travel baseball, it's hard to justify a $3,000 deer lease that you get to hunt twice a year.
Exactly. Yep.
Well, and we've done that to ourselves, sort of, you know. I mean, that's the one thing that bugs me a little bit, Scott. The folks that don't hunt, you know, the non-consumptive users or whatever you want to call them, that like watching their deer. That's one thing, and that may be a bit of a higher hill to climb, but the other stuff is hunters. Hunters causing lack of access for other hunters. I mean, I know that sounds bad in some ways because we are all on the same team, but at some point, every one of us is just going to have to take a piece of humble pie and say, you know, maybe I don't need this much. Or maybe I don't need to kill that big of a buck. I don't know. It's hard to do once you've gotten to that point in your hunting career. Absolutely hard to do. But
it really is. You know, Aaron, you and I have talked about this before with the kind of the elitist type of especially with deer hunters. You know, it's deer hunting, whitetail hunting, I think has created, you know, this persona more than anything else, and it's because they have antlers. You know, if turkeys and squirrels had antlers and you could score them, it'd be different. They'd also create this same trophy type of connotation. But you know, I'm not beating up trophy hunters because I am one. You know, I like to harvest a mature deer. That's what I'm after, is one that's old and put in his time and that I've outsmarted. You know, that's what I want to do. But I can tell you that it's changed the culture of hunting, not just deer hunting, of hunting overall. It's changed our level of access. It's changed the way the industry works. If you want to see how the industry works, and if you want to see the products that the industry is putting out, it's 90% deer. And it's 90% focused on those avid folks who want to kill bigger bucks. And it's not really focused on taking more people hunting. It's not focused on a great family experience. It's not focused on that camp anymore. It's not focused on having that social aspect that deer hunting used to be about. it's focused on killing bigger, more mature bucks. That's what it's focused on. And, you know, it'd be easy for me to sit here and be really, really critical of that. I can't be, because I love it. I love doing it. But the unintended, and I fully believe it's an unintended circumstance, is that we are truly losing the culture and the heritage that we love because of it.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, I would agree with that.
Deer camp. Well, go ahead, I mean, Aaron, Chris, you've been to, that's how we grew up, was deer camp in the fall.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
And enjoying that with your buddies and telling hunting stories and all that stuff. I mean, you think it's a pretty minor thing at that time, but, I mean, in a lot of those situations, that's where you learn to hunt. And that's where you build some of the lifelong friendships that you have. And you know, if you bring somebody new to deer camp this year, you get them involved. And then they get their kids involved. And then their kids get their friends involved. And it's a chain reaction. But like Scott said, nowadays, especially up here in Iowa, a lot of the land is no longer owned by local folks. Yeah. And that means the local residents here that live next to that land can't access it like they used to. And that's why I'm a big proponent of public land, but that, you know, there's not near enough of it out there to support what we need to do as far as hunter recruitment goes. But I don't know, maybe at some point we just need to rethink, you know, how much we actually need and what we can do, because I think the only way that this is going to get fixed is from the inside. We're going to have to be the ones that fix it. Hunters as a group are going to have to fix it. And if people aren't proactively getting involved in their legislatures and their communities and stuff to do it, I mean, you could be looking at some really scary stuff, if I'm correct, right, Scott?
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you what my fear is. And, you know, there's nothing in the world I like better than hunting. And I have a 10-year-old who there's nothing in the world I like more than for him to grow up as a hunter and have the opportunities and the passion and the love for it that I did. But I am extremely fearful that the scenario that's setting itself up, it's kind of the perfect storm, is actually going to happen. And that is, the majority of people that we have that are licensed hunters right now, and certainly in the avid hunter group, and even to a large degree anglers, those individuals are in your 45 to 70-year-old age bracket right now. And a large number of them are 55 to 65 with a kind of a peak right there in the early 60s. And so what we're seeing is, as those individuals age, as that cohort moves down the age line, they're not being replaced nearly enough by the folks that are in their 30s and their 20s and even the youth. And youth numbers are difficult to get a hold of because of privacy acts and different things like that. We may be seeing a little bit of a bump because of some of the youth programs that we're already doing with state agencies. It's really hard to track. And so if you think about that cohort moving down this track, what we've seen when people hit 70 years old is they stop hunting because they're not capable of it anymore. They can't get out and do it. They don't feel comfortable going by themselves. And quite honestly, once they get to 75 to 80, the number of people that hunt at 75 and 80 years old, it drops down to almost nothing. And so if you think about that, if you think about what's going to happen and you think about that cohort moving down time, we're reaching a cliff is what we're reaching. And what we're going to see is, in about 10 to 15 years, we're going to see this dramatic, steep decline in the number of people that we have that are hunting and the number of people that are buying hunting licenses and fishing licenses. That's going to have a domino effect. Just like I said before, it's going to have a domino effect on funding. And the state wildlife agencies, who primarily manage the wildlife in every state, are going to be in financial situation where license sales is no longer going to be something that can support them. And they're not going to be able to manage the resource anymore. So public lands as we know them, and even private land programs as we know them, and just game management, being able to set good regulations, being able to do the biology and the reproductive studies and the surveys necessary to make good decisions about game populations and wildlife, that's really going to suffer. And it may suffer to the point that we see steep declines in wildlife and habitat. And honestly, I think that's what it's going to take. I don't, you know, just by human nature, I think it's going to take something pretty dramatic. People are going to have to start seeing it impact them personally before they want to take action. And my fear is it'll be too late. It'll be too late to change it because we will have started the decline in such a way that we can't turn it around.
Well, I've heard the exact same things you're talking about too through my circles. Yeah, I mean, even within the industry, a lot of the manufacturers and the brands that are propping it up right now are aware of this, and they're trying to find ways of, you know, fixing the problem. And what, Chris, you talked to me about archery in the schools, and Scott and I have talked about this a lot. It's an activity that younger folks can get involved in. It's like, you know, a door that opens, sort of like, you know, FFA trap was for us when we were younger or whatever. And yep. Scott's got a lot of knowledge and background in that. Does Paris have an archery program or any programs like that involved in outdoors?
We don't actually have an archery program at our school. Our particular insurance company frowned upon that, and we tried to fight them a little bit on it. And so we ended up working closely with our 4-H, our local 4-H organization. And so we do have a lot of kids that are starting to shoot more with that. You know, a few other things. There's a local gentleman from Paris that opened up an indoor range, and I've noticed a lot of kids after school that are starting to go by there and they're starting to shoot a little bit. And so we've got that going on. You mentioned FFA trap. We've got kids that are shooting trap, and we're actually incorporating several females into that group. And so we've got a lot of kids that are really interested in that and starting to get, it's neat to see, but starting to get some of their parents that weren't, you know, shooters or recreational shooters or outdoorsmen at all, that are starting to enjoy it and starting to see that as a possible connection with their kids. And you know, there's a few other things that we try to do as a school. I know, with our eighth grade students, they all have an ag class, and in that class, we get those kids, get their boater's license. And also they take a portion of the hunter fishermen, they work through the book. They aren't completely certified, but at least it gets them headed in that direction. And then hopefully we can work with our local conservation department to go ahead and get those kids to finish that and get those kids excited about the outdoors. So there's some things that we're trying, and as their principal, you know, any kid that I see in the halls that hunts or fishes, you know, I seek those kids out and ask them how their season's going, if they're having any luck, and if they've been fortunate enough to harvest something, you know, to share those pictures. And so we try to make, a big deal about it in a rural community, to really talk it up to those kids. And I try to do it in front of other students too. So it's, you know, maybe it can trigger, you know, that reaction. Where those kids, where they want to join in.
That's great. You know, we do have a couple of bright spots. It's just some of the things you were talking about. If you look at the data, I mentioned female hunters and anglers being recruited. Mm-hmm. But we also see a really clear increase in the number of teenage to early 20-year-old shotgun shooters.
Yes.
The National Shooting Sports Foundation has done a tremendous number of surveys, and they have some wonderful data that indicate that bump is because of the Scholastic shooting programs. It's because mm-hmm. of the Scholastic play target program specifically, where they actually have high school sponsored teams, and they have high school kids that can shoot on teams. It's well funded. It's well organized. They have coaches. They have tournaments. They have practices. It's just what I was talking about. It's very structured. It's very safe, very controlled. And it is actually through the school and through the community. So these kids, you know, it's what their friends are doing. Just like baseball, just like basketball, it's what my buddies are doing. So they started shooting. Well, they've actually seen an increase nationwide in the number of young shotgun shooters. Now, that's not always transferring over to hunting, you know, not all of them become hunters. But they are seeing that, and everybody's starting to really look at that as a way to say, hey, could we apply that to fishing? Could we apply that to hunting? We're the Union Sportsman's Alliance that I'm over, we're looking at what we call first catch centers with the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation. And we're trying to build these first catch centers where it's actually a place where people go to learn to fish. And it's actually a curriculum and a reoccurring event where they can come and do little derbies and tournaments and have teams and have their friends over there and have their families come out. I honestly think there's something to that, and I think that that is the future of recruiting these new folks, especially youth and their families, into the hunting and fishing and shooting. I just don't think we can do it like we used to. Things have changed. Culture's changed. People have changed. Hunting, just like we said, especially deer hunting, it's changed. And I think that the only way we're going to recruit people at a high level is to get the youth involved and honestly get their families involved. If you think about, and I know you guys are exactly like me, if you think about how you got started because of somebody that was related to you or somebody you were close to was a hunter, and they took you. You know, my grandfather took me, and after that, my dad took me. And I know you guys have similar stories. The only way I think that we're going to be able to do hunting and fishing on any scale, to make it scalable, is you've got to get the parents involved, and you've got to show them that it's a safe, fun, healthy lifestyle. And the first thing you have to do is get the kids involved. And the kids, I believe, will bring the parents into it. And that's kind of backwards from the way we did it before, but I really feel like that's what's going to have to happen.
Well, I mean,
yeah, I would agree with that. I mean,
that's tons of good advice. Sorry, go ahead. And that's why I brought both of you on this podcast, is because Chris is a good example in to set in your community. You know, I mean, you're the principal of the school. You influence lots of kids mm-hmm. every single day, and even their parents. And you're setting a good example for them in a community, in a small community where everybody knows everybody. I mean, that sounds like a small step, but it's really not. If you have a few of those people in every community, you know, across the board, you can start to really make some hay in the right direction. And Scott, with USA, how can people get more involved with that, and any other organizations that can help to maybe try to defeat this thing?
You bet. Well, it's not just the Union Sportsman's Alliance that's out there doing this. You know, the Union Sportsman's Alliance, we represent about 6 million union members across the nation right now. And most of them are what we call trade professionals. So they're iron workers and steel workers and electricians and plumbers and pipe fitters and welders. They do all these different trade things. We know that about 80% of them hunt and fish. And so we're trying to use their knowledge and their background and their love and passion to bring on this next generation, whether it's their grandkids, whether it's their kids, whether it's the neighbor's kids down the road that need to get involved. We're trying to get them involved in the outdoors and make it easier for them to be mentors, make it easier for them to take kids fishing and hunting and have these community events. So that's the way that the Union Sportsman's Alliance is connecting. We also do a lot of infrastructure. We make it easier for people to utilize the outdoors. We help with trailheads and, you know, signs, and we help some of the maintenance costs that the wildlife agencies are experiencing and fisheries as well. You know, some of the things they can't fix, they need a boat dock, we'll build a boat dock for them because we have skilled trades and we have money. There are a lot of other organizations out there that are doing similar things with hunter recruitment and different mentoring activities. Pheasants Forever is doing a great job. Of course, the National Wild Turkey Federation that I just came from, I spent 17 years there as vice president. Ducks Unlimited does a good number of mentoring opportunities. There's a lot of the NGOs, and then if you look on the internet, nearly every state agency has some type of a youth recruitment program. Mm-hmm. And the biggest problem that they have right now is finding mentors. They need people who will give their time and their knowledge to come out and help teach these families, a lot of these folks are young adults that want to learn how to hunt and fish, but they need people who have the expertise and have the background and are willing to give up some of their time hunting and fishing to teach others how to do it. And quite honestly, if you want to get involved, that state agency is the right route to do it, because they will connect you with these other nonprofit conservation organizations like us.
Well, for those of you that heard that out there, the state agency is what will do it. That's what Scott just said. And I know a lot of you over the years have gotten, you know, perturbed at your state agency for one thing or another. I mean, me and Chris have been fighting that rifle season in the middle of the rut in Missouri for years and years. But
oh my goodness.
The point I'm making there is that's a small battle. You know, this is what we're talking about, the war here. If you can support your state agency, and MDC, Missouri Department of Conservation, does a lot of great things that bordering states don't.
I completely agree. Yep.
From a political standpoint, how do folks get involved there? I know that's a touchy subject as well, but if we can get more folks to advocate for their DNRs or for their conservation agencies, that will mean more money in the long term. Am I correct, Scott? I mean, how do people get more involved with the political side of things?
Absolutely. Here's my advice there, and it's pretty general. This almost sounds like something you'd read on, you know, Facebook or something. Here's what I recommend that people do if they are avid conservationists, fishermen, hunters, recreational shooters, and they want to help their state agency and in turn help themselves, because ultimately it's going to help them. They have to find things within that state and within their pastime and what they love that unify everybody rather than divide. Because for way too long, we found every reason in the world to divide each other. You know, I don't like the people that hunt with modern muzzleloaders. You know, I'm a flintlock muzzleloader hunter, and he shouldn't be out there hunting at the same time I am. Same thing with bow hunters. You know, I should have a longer season because it's harder to kill a deer with a bow, right?
Missouri went to crossbows this year during bow season. that was kind of an issue. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So we need to find ways to unify hunters and anglers and shooters together within that state agency holding environment so that we can all work together for a brighter future for everybody. So you have to find that common ground. And sometimes that's really hard, because it's really hard to look past, how is this affecting me right now? How is it affecting me today or this season? Or how's my deer season going to be? But when you look down the road, you look 20 years from now, and you think, okay, the people that come after me, they need to be able to deer hunt too. And I may have to give up just a little bit in order to make that happen.
That Keep It Public campaign is exactly what you're talking about, I'm pretty sure.
It is. It absolutely is.
I mean, that unifies people like anti-hunters almost. I mean, basically, they took the one stance, like, protect public lands. That's our only interest. We don't care if you're Democrat, Republican, whatever. They said,
that's right,
we're going to protect public lands. And the non-consumptive users that don't like hunters are hiking out there and looking at trees or whatever. And then the hunters are all out there, too. And they're standing right next to each other. And they've been able to make some serious strides in that, in the political arena, in just the last year. We're going to need something similar to that for this issue too. I have a feeling
that you hit the nail on the head. As long as we fight each other, we actually make it easier for the anti-hunters to divide and conquer when we do that. If you look back, you mentioned anti-hunters. It's one of the things that, you know, I've dealt with my entire career.
Yep.
The anti-hunters, they have a strategy, and their strategy is to divide hunters and anglers and those who are consumptive users into smaller segments, because they know they can beat them. You know, if they can get you to say, hey, I don't agree with baiting bears, okay, now I've got a guy that says he hunts, but he doesn't want to bait. And so we can systematically break down and take down hunting because we can divide these folks. See what I'm saying? Whereas if we'll just say, hey, we enjoy hunting, and you know, you hunt the way you want, you hunt, and I'll hunt the way that I want to hunt, but we're both hunters. We're kindred spirits. We're going to protect each other. We're going to have each other's back, right? As long as you do it ethically, you do it legally, and you do it morally, I'm with you, brother. As long as we do that, we're good. If they can divide us, they win. And they have won a lot of battles that way. And quite honestly, we all lose when we find these divisional things to fight over.
We have, in Missouri, Chris, don't we have a sales tax on all, and Scott, you know this too, I'm sure, on all basically hunting products that are purchased in the state? Is it something like that?
Yes. Yeah. I want to say it's on absolutely anything. It's by fishing lures, fishing tackle, you know, any kind of ammunition, anything at all in regards to hunting. Yes, I believe that there is a tax on that.
There's also, Aaron, in Missouri specifically, there's a 1/8% sales tax.
Yes.
And so, you know, it doesn't sound like a lot. It doesn't sound like a big amount, but if you take every bit of sales tax that's collected in the state of Missouri on everything, and you do 1/8%, that goes back to the Missouri Department of Conservation, and it's a big number. I don't remember exactly what it is, but it's one of the reasons that the Missouri Department of Conservation is better funded than nearly any other state agency in the nation.
Yeah, and we give them a lot of grief, but you know, their hunter decline is much slower than a lot of these other states. And one reason is because they have lots more public land. They've got more opportunity. And like you said, I mean, they're just better funded. They've got more irons in the fire, more people to play the game. And like I'd mentioned before, Iowa is just going downhill every year. It seems like it's just like there hasn't been an end for quite some time. And, you know, I mean, we're the place everybody in the country wants to hunt deer. And if at some point we don't have an agency, you know, I mean, what happens then? It's not good. But
it's probably a microcosm of the entire nation.
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about.
But I think we've uncovered a lot on the podcast tonight. I'm sure we could dive into tons more, but I just wanted to get everybody kind of thinking about this a little bit. I'm gonna try to do more of these. Try to have Randy Newberg on, and we'll talk about the access issues and public lands across the whitetail range and stuff like that in the future, which I think will be beneficial. But is there any last thoughts you guys have got that you want to add, Chris or Scott?
Scott, go ahead.
I was waiting on you.
Put you on a spot.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, the one thing that I would leave everybody with is if we keep doing what we're doing, we can expect the same results. And the same results are we're not adding hunters nearly as fast as we're losing them. We've seen a little bit of an increase in fishing and angling, and that's because we've had a lot of programs, spent a lot of money on those programs. I think that that everybody as a conservationist, certainly as a hunter, we have to kind of reflect on what we're doing, what's our part, you know, what are we doing to help fix the problem? Because it's one thing to talk about it, it's one thing to recognize it, but it's a whole other thing to take action and do something about it. And I think that if everybody kind of reflects on what their part of the problem is, you know, how am I creating some of this problem? And then they think about what are one or two things that I can do this season to help offset this problem and help the future of something that I love so much and I cherish so much. If everybody will do that and everybody will take some personal ownership and get involved in these state programs with these nonprofit organizations, we'll be all right. But it's just like you said, Aaron, it's going to come down to the individual doing the right thing. And the right thing right now is to take some action.
Chris?
And I'd say it's been a really refreshing conversation, you know, because I'd say in years past, I've probably been a part of the problem. I consider myself to be a fairly selfish hunter from time to time, you know, more worried about, you know, what I've got, you know, than everybody else out there. But, you know, we do got to take a step back and we got to look at it, you know, more long term. I want my three children to be able to hunt. I want their kids to be able to hunt and experience the outdoors and enjoy it. And, you know, it's a scary, it's been a scary conversation as well, you know, in talking with Aaron and hearing some of the numbers, you know, that are out there. It's, we definitely got to do what we can. And, you know, on my part, I would say, you know, I get to work with the youth every day. You know, for anybody out there that has a chance to take a kid outdoors, have them put the cell phone down for a minute, step away from the iPad or whatever it is, and take them outside, take them fishing, take them shooting, take them hunting, and make it a real positive experience for them, because I do think it's something that's very important, and it can be very fulfilling in their lives. I know it has been in mine, and obviously in yours as well. So just take kids out there, make sure that it's real positive. And grab your friends too. I mean, you know, you mentioned we got to get adults out there as well. We got to recruit, you know, everybody. But just make it a positive experience and let people know, you know, how passionate we are about it and what it means to us.
I couldn't agree with you guys more. And like I said, I really appreciate you both taking times out of your families tonight and visiting with me about this. I can't thank you enough. And y'all. I'll be down home here pretty soon, Chris. We might have to go run around and scout for some bucks.
Yeah, once you swing by and let me know when you're around, we'll have to get together for sure.
All right,
I'm
buddy.
I'm still waiting on that invitation up there to Iowa.
Oh, now, you know that's BS. You're welcome up here whenever you want. I tried to get you out to go turkey hunting in Tennessee this year, but like you mentioned earlier, you're a busy man running around.
You got it.
Yeah.
You got it.
Well, appreciate it, guys. I mean, this has been a very refreshing conversation. Thanks a lot to the both of you. Well, that's going to wrap up another Whitetail Watch podcast this week. Big thanks to Chris and Scott for coming on. I hope you all got a lot out of that conversation. It was a very, very important one. And like they were mentioning in the close, all of us need to do something. If it can be something small. If everybody does something, then we may be able to possibly avoid this problem in the future. I mean, take a new person hunting. If you've got access to tons of land and you're on a giant buck and passing up all these other ones, whatever, take the neighbor kid out. Don't think twice about it, because what you're doing is you're involving someone new in the outdoors, and that's what we're going to need moving forward. Those are the people, the license holders, that pay for these state agencies. They're the ones that pay for our pastime. We're all in this together, and we definitely need to start working together soon. So with that being said, I hope everybody enjoyed the podcast. I will have another one up here in the next few weeks, and we'll see you next time right here, the Whitetail Watch podcast, presented by Realtree at MidwestWhitetail.com.